those moments thrill and exhilarate you? Do you want to be a part of the excitement? Join the CITR Sports Collective. The show airs every Thursday at 3:30 p.m. and live broadcasts volleyball and basketball games at the War Memorial Gym. We need collective members like you to host color commentary and talk all things UBC sports. Everyone is welcome and there's no experience necessary. Email volunteer at CITR.ca to get involved.
To understand more about fashion, we asked CITR student executive and fashion expert Jonathan Q what fashion means to him.
Like, it's just aesthetically something that's so ostentatious. Typically. I mean, because of course, I mean, it's also, you know, I mean, when you say fashion, I think people are talking explicitly about consumerism as opposed to someone who buys, like, you know, let's say, you know, someone buys a clothing.
If you really want to know more about fashion, come on down to CITR in the Student Union Building of UBC and pick up some of our merchandise à la mode. Nous avons t-shirts, sweatshirts, socks, and coffee mugs.
But it's also very aesthetically gripping.
To keep you styling in support of the station you love. Isn't that right, Jonathan?
Well, actually, is it? Because, I mean, you know, I was going to say because of the cultural vacuum that we exist within, but then, you know, really, fashion today is kind of derived from the European idea of couture, and that's been around for centuries.
You never see me again.
Ebola.
Xin chào và hẹn gặp lại.
Happy birthday.
Trời ơi.
I go to National Engineering College.
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 Fridays from 2 to 3:30 p.m., it's the Beppe Crespin Presents radio show.
It's CITR's 24 hours of radio art in a snack-sized format.
Difficult music, harsh electronics, dark ambient, drone, spoken word, cut up collage, and general Crespin weirdness.
Beppe Crespin Presents, Fridays at 2 p.m. on CITR FM 101.9.
Streaming at player.citr.ca.
You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam and Coast Salish territory. This is UBC Happy Hour, a show that is all about what's happening on UBC's campus, produced by the UBC Affairs Collective. If you like what you hear and you want to help, send us an email to ubcaffairs@citr.ca. I'm Lillane.
I'm Amy.
I'm Sadie.
And I'm Alex, and welcome to the show, everyone. We're super excited about today's episode because in anticipation of Valentine's Day, which is happening next Wednesday, if you're not ready, get ready now and go out and consume for Valentine's Day because we're all
such a consumer holiday. I'm really against it.
Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe don't consume this Valentine's Day.
Fight go consume.
Well, I fully intend on eating the Reese's hearts that have like they're like Reese's but in the shape of peanut butter. Also in Canada, you call them Reese's, which I don't understand.
What do you call them?
Wait,
in the
what?
Reese's? It's Reese's. Like there's an apostrophe S here. It's just Reese.
No, it's Reese's.
No, I'm 100% sure.
I've always called it Reese's. I disagree.
Reese's Pieces.
Reese's Pieces.
Yeah. Okay, well, eat some of those. Eat some of those. But, yeah, so don't consume or consume. It's up to you. You have a choice. But we're talking about actually more kind of ideas related to love on this week's episode. So, we're talking about love on campus, on UBC campus, and kind of dating in the modern...
Hooking up, you know?
Yeah, hooking up too, not just love. But yeah, kind of the modern, like, dating, hooking up, love experience. So, first off, Jen Brulé, who is a contributor on the show, we went out yesterday and spoke to some students about what it's like dating on campus and whether they're in relationships or not. And yeah, it was kind of a little bit surprising, I think, to me what kind of the consensus was among students. But we're going to listen to that and then we're going to kind of discuss what it's like to date on campus. Mm-hmm.
I wasn't surprised.
I'm single as well, kind of. So what does that mean for school? Is it better being single, or do you think it's...
Yes. I dated someone last year who wasn't in school, and then we broke up because he was like, how come you're not hanging out with me? I was like, well, I have school.
Stage five clinger.
Yeah, right? He didn't understand that, like, school takes priority over him because, like, my grades will determine the rest of my life, and he was, like, definitely not going to be with me for my whole life, so it's hard. I think the conclusion to that story is that...
I feel like it frees up a lot of your time when you're single, because, like, when you're in a relationship, like, that's one of your priorities is being with that person, spending time with them, so...
Because there isn't any females in engineering?
There are definitely, the ratio is a little off, I'd say. There's a lot of guys.
Have you talked to a girl in your program? Yes.
I know them, like I'm friends with them. It's just, I don't know, there's not a lot of like opportunities.
Would you ever just say, hey, would you like to go on a date with me?
Like, I could, I just haven't really found someone that I would like to say that to.
Do you find it hard to balance your coursework with dating?
At least I found when you're in groups or when you're working with, you know, like other female students, like in engineering, like you don't really want to go there, you know, like it's not like you're like comfortably kind of introduced to, I don't know, you know, like the ratios are already so skewed and you feel, it feels really awkward to kind of go after somebody who's like, a, like, you know, in engineering. I don't know, personally, that's just kind of what I found. I'm also not really involved with a lot of like groups and stuff like that maybe will kind of bring me closer to like my peers in engineering, you know, so I don't really have a lot of networking with you know, fellow students in terms of that as well, but yeah, basically not really on campus.
That was a really good answer. I was just about to be like, so you don't want to shit where you eat, essentially.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, that's an eloquent way of putting it, you know, couldn't put it in better words myself, right? But
okay, so you guys started dating in university. So how did you guys meet?
We met in...
So we actually met in high school, and then we were part of this business fraternity together in university.
Ooh, business fraternity?
Yeah, so we were part of this investment portfolio, and he was my senior analyst, and I was a junior analyst. Very romantic.
That's naughty.
I know, nothing makes you fall in love like Excel spreadsheets, let me tell you.
So do you think that being part of extracurriculars is helpful to like meeting potential dates when you're in university?
For sure, I'd say so. At least it gives you something that you have in common, at least something you can bond over. Mm-hmm.
Did you guys find it hard to balance school life with being in a relationship?
Not really, because we got really lucky and we lived right across from each other.
Yeah, and then also I guess we're also in the same like faculty and then also in the in like extracurriculars together, so it wasn't too hard to coordinate.
So when's the wedding?
Ask me like 8 more years down the road.
Okay, thanks guys.
Thanks.
Okay, so that was our streeter, kind of going around campus. And I don't know, I mean, personally, I thought it was going to be like a really, I don't know, like kind of fun-loving experience. But fun-loving, I don't know what that means.
I thought you were going to get some wild stories.
Yeah, we did. So one of the guys did kind of tell us a story, but I don't know, it was kind of long to put on. But he kind of told us about how, like, he had been dating this girl and... And she moved to Montreal, and he's going to Montreal for reading break, and so he's gonna stay with her, like, but yeah.
Oh my goodness!
But the clincher is that she now lives with her new boyfriend.
Oh.
And she did not, like, I guess, tell him that she,
wow.
She told him, like, I'm living with my new boyfriend. But she has not told her boyfriend that they previously dated. And so I guess she was kind of like, you know, keep it under wraps.
That's such a soap opera. I want to know what happened.
Yeah. So that was kind of the condensed version of the story. But like that was, he was just like, do you want to hear a story? We're like, yeah.
I think he really just needed to tell someone about it, you know?
Yeah, like, okay. But like a big theme that came up in that was that people aren't really dating because it seems like they don't really have time to date. So... What do you guys think of that? Like, do you have time to date, or do you think that it's possible
you
to
make
be...
time for what you want? Right.
I would love to ask all those people how many hours did they spend watching Netflix, and you know, or how much, or like what time did they wake up? You know, it really does take a lot of time out of your day when you wake up at 1 p.m. you know, whereas if you're like, I was up at like early, you know, you then you have a whole long day, you can get so much done, and then you know, you have time for whatever.
That's a good point. I think it's not like so much time like to like when they have a significant other, like to be spending time with that person. It's finding time looking for someone. They don't want to find that time, like spend that time looking and then failing, because that sucks.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's so hard to like look and find, and then
yeah, there's that fear, like
So speaking of looking, do you guys use any like online dating platforms that are specifically made for like looking for a potential like date or love interest, I guess?
I mean,
or a hookup. I don't know. Yeah. by date, I mean like I could just be a hookup as well.
Yeah, I do.
You do? Okay. Yeah. And have you had any like success from it? Like, have you gone on good dates, or have they mostly?
I've been on some fine ones. I went on a really bad one yesterday. it's a mixed bag.
Okay. Cause yeah, I think one thing about, so I like recently downloaded Tinder, had it for like 5 days, kind of more as like a, I don't know, maybe personal social experiment. And yeah, I mean, I think it's like, I actually think it's kind of fun. And I think it's like a good distraction. Like I'm kind of going through heartbreak, so it's kind of fun just to like try it. But I do, I think it's just so superficial that I think it's not that it's impossible to like meet someone that you could really connect with on that platform, but I don't really think that you can like meet someone on an online dating platform and know whether they're going to be good for you or not before you've met them. Like I think like you just have to meet them
eventually.
Yeah,
there is so much like thing, like unspoken things in body language and just how they interact, and it's little things, you know, that determine, I think, whether you like a person or not.
Yeah, and sometimes, like, I've kind of swiped through Tinder, and I'm just like, wait, what if I just swiped left to my one true love? But, you know, like, maybe that's a cynical way of looking at it.
I mean, some people would argue then that they're going to find you, and, you know, if it's really your true love, like, it's going to all work out.
Yeah, yeah. But, okay, so Lilaine and Amy, you guys don't have any... Like, you guys don't use online dating.
No.
No, I do not.
Does getting messages from F-boys count?
No, it does not. What is an F-boy? I, you guys are a bit younger than me, so, like, I feel like I need to learn what you this
is. I mean, my initial answer was the worst, but...
So it's like a player, kind of?
It's like a text slide into your DMs. Boy,
I think it's almost like on a really casual level, someone who's like just using you, they're like just want to like have sex with you. Mm. Like, there's no, they're just like, it's like
an ego boost for them.
Ego boost. It's just like kind of like, I don't know,
it's an attitude, it's a way of dressing, but like the style, like, I feel like varies place to place. You know, like, I mean, I feel like at every school, maybe I'm making a generalization, that there's like a certain way that the type of boy looks, but it's different everywhere you go.
I don't want to get too feminist here, but I think it's a guy who sees girls as something to attain and not as like a person to connect with.
True. Well said.
This is still like prevalent in our culture. What? Why haven't we come further than this?
We won't learn. That's why. Sorry, man.
No, I think it's that we don't teach them. It's not a question of learning. It's how we teach them.
That's true. I mean, our media is still very much...
Oh, yes, definitely.
It has a lot of gender stereotypes. So they're just copying that.
Okay, so that being said, do we think that, like, as women, we're all heterosexual women, have you guys ever, like, asked out a guy...
I'm too scared to. Well, I've sent like on Instagram, but then that's only like asking out, right?
I haven't, but I'm planning to soon. It's gonna happen, guys.
I've never explicitly asked someone out, but I've definitely been like, "Here's my number, call me." You know, like
okay, yeah.
Well, I've done that too.
Like, or like written it on you know, something, been like, here's, you know, I said the same thing, but I've never been like, all right, meet me here. Here's the time. Here's the place. Like, let's go, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I asked someone out, like, I don't know, maybe a month or so ago. No, like 2 months ago, because I was kind of, yeah, honestly, I was just like, screw it, you know? And I had known him before. And like, and then I found out, and then he told me that he actually had a girlfriend now. But it was, I think, empowering to ask him out. Like, I think that there's really something to be said about, like, you're controlling your dating life. And so instead of, like, waiting to be asked out, you're just going to go for it. And it kind of, I think, goes back to what Dr. Marina Adshade, who was the economist who was on our show, was talking about, which was, like, this gatekeeper model of consent that's so rooted in, like, men are the ones to ask women out and to pursue sex, and we are, as women, are the ones to say yes or no. And I think that, like, part of feminism should really include women asking men out.
Taking initiative, yeah. Yeah, and also, like, sometimes, like, men just don't get the hint. I'm bashing men a lot, I'm sorry. But, like, I don't know, I was talking to this guy, and he was like, what are you doing this week? And I'm like, nothing, I'm not doing anything. And he's like, well, I'm doing this. And I'm like, well, okay, I wanted it to be with me, but fine, whatever.
Yeah, I think most girls would just, like, their way of kind of getting a guy is just, like, flirting with them and trying to, like, give them, like, hints, but then they never really get it, do they?
Yeah, you need to kind of, like, spell it out for dudes.
Sometimes,
yeah.
I feel like it has to be spelled out for me in a number of situations. Oops.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, kind of, I think, so the next interview that we're going to play is with Mandy Catron, who is an English prof and a creative writing prof here at UBC. And yeah, she is, you're going to hear about what she's done with love with her work. But it's just really, I think her interview really ties into this idea that we were talking about of, like, kind of taking love into your own hands and being kind of purposeful with your love. So yeah. Okay, so this is Alex Lenz from CITR, and I am sitting in a beautiful Alice in Wonderland, like, tea shop with Mandy Catron, who is a professor at UBC and a writer. So could you please just introduce yourself and your affiliation to UBC?
Yeah, so I teach English in the Department of English, and I've been doing that for 11 years now. And I also teach creative writing through the continuing studies program.
Awesome. So first I want to talk to you about what everyone wants to talk to you about, which is a 2015 article that you published in the New York Times, and it was called To Fall in Love with Anyone, Do This. And it received a lot of attention. It was part of the Modern Love column, which I know a lot of our listeners love the Modern Love column. I think a lot of people really like the Modern Love column. Yeah, so could you just tell us about that article quickly?
Yeah, so basically I've been researching romantic love for many years and writing about it on a blog that I made in hopes that it would become a book. And I was interested in thinking about love from a more interdisciplinary perspective. I felt like most of the knowledge I had about love was from love stories, and that maybe those love stories weren't doing me much good. So one of the things that happened is lots of people like to talk to me about love, and I was out on a date one night. It was a first date, and I really didn't even know it was a date, with an acquaintance, and he said to me, I have this theory that you can fall in love with anyone, and if so, how do you choose? And I thought that was a really interesting question, and I started thinking about this idea about whether or not it's possible to fall in love with anyone, and I thought of this study that I had read about a few years earlier. Basically, the way the study works, and I told him about it, is two people walk into a lab. They take turns asking each other 36 increasingly personal questions, and then they stare into each other's eyes for 4 minutes without speaking. And basically, the goal of the study was to see if they could create romantic love in the laboratory. So because I thought this guy was kind of cute, I said, I've always wanted to try it. And he said, let's do it. And so we did. And it was a really interesting experience. And I was going to write about it for my blog, but then I thought, this is a good story. Like, I should see if someone will pay me to write about it. And I sent it a couple places, but eventually it found a home at the New York Times in the Modern Love column. And I was expecting maybe a few thousand readers, but it got like 8 million views in the first month. Like, it was crazy.
Yeah, so that was, you know, a really personal experience. And it became, as you said, super popular. So, yeah, how did it feel to have such a personal experience become so, discussed kind of in, like, popular culture?
It felt really strange. You know, I had this blog. I had been writing about love for a long time. I was really comfortable writing about love and in personal ways. Like, I write nonfiction. I write memoir and essays. So all of that was okay with me, you know, and I was used to kind of feeling like I'm actively making choices about what parts of my life I want to share and what I don't. I think people often assume that when you write about yourself, you're sharing everything, but the reality is, like, I'm quite thoughtful about it and very particular. So I was really comfortable writing about this kind of thing, but I wasn't prepared for the level of interest and to have other people write about it. I think our relationship, so we started dating about 3 months after we actually did that study. So when the article came out, I think we had been together like 3 or 4 months, not long. And so it was really hard, like, having this new relationship, like reading about my own relationship in the news. I think it was a lot harder on me than it was on my partner, who's just like a really relaxed, easygoing person and thought it was interesting and kind of funny. it was weird.
Do you find that it gets really misconstrued, but do you find that, people will kind of interpret it kind of in the way in which they want to, and then does that kind of misconstrue them?
Yeah. I mean, right after it came out, I remember listening to this podcast, Slate XX podcast, which is like women talking about current events, and they started talking about the article, and they said, oh, she met her husband this way, and I thought, oh my God, like, no. But people see what they want. Yeah, so a lot of the reports were like, by the end of the evening, they were falling in love, which wasn't my experience either, you know, and so I think it's like when the narrative is in my control, when I'm writing about myself and my partner and the people I love, it's like, that's comfortable territory for me. When other people are writing about it, that's when I start to feel a little less comfortable.
Yeah. I mean, clearly, I think that the reason, you know, it became so popular, like, that means that there's a reason, like, there's a reason why it became so popular. And so clearly, like, people are really interested in this idea of the 36-question dating experience, or, you know. Yeah. And, so part of the show that, you know, we're looking at is, you know, it's modern dating and kind of the experience in 2018. And one thing that we were finding when we were interviewing students was that people were like, I have no time to date. Like, I'm so busy. And, you know, like, the popularization of dating apps and, you know, people are kind of, it's almost like we need to make specific time for dating. It doesn't kind of happen organically. Do you think that there's kind of like an element of dating with a purpose that's maybe inherent in this 36-question dating kind of experience?
So there are a couple things I want to say in response to this. So one is, part of why I think my article was so popular was that people were really interested, especially in the era of online dating, of having a mechanism to, like, deeply connect with another person. Like, I think what the study sort of promises is a way to be heard, a way to be known, like, really known, really seen by someone else. And I think, like, in the era of online dating, because the study's been around, like, over 20 years, right? So I think in the era of online dating, suddenly it has maybe a more immediate appeal, because now we have more potential partners than ever, which I think is usually a good thing. But the result is, like, you can go on a Tinder date every night of the week, and you're not necessarily, like, you're sort of trading that deep connection for a a lot of superficial connections. And I think, at least my experience with online dating, was that it often felt like, you know, people frequently compare it to like a job interview or like shopping for a partner. And I think this is like the antithesis of that. This is like, I'm going to sit down with you and like really hear what you have to say and really like make myself vulnerable. And so I think that was meaningful to people. That's like really appealing. So I think that's part of it. The other thing that I would say is I feel like there's this sort of panic that you hear in the media about millennials. My students and I, so I teach classes on love, and it's not like I'm not teaching students how to fall in love. We read a combination of like cultural criticism and personal essay and scholarly research about love. And it's pretty interesting, and we have a lot of interesting conversations. And one of the things that we find a lot is this like cultural panic, which is like millennials and even the next generation, like they don't know how to love. They're afraid to be vulnerable. And while maybe there's like a bit of truth to that, I think it's also true that like your generation faces some challenges that previous generations didn't face. It's not an economically friendly environment for like going out with an undergrad degree and getting a job. And so I think there's an emphasis on education. There's an emphasis on, as you were saying, like connecting with your peers, intimate friendships. It's not like there's a total absence of intimacy. It's just that intimacy isn't necessarily romantic. But people get married later than they used to. And getting married later usually means that relationships last longer. People make better choices. So, like, I'm not too worried about people, which I just wanted to say.
Okay, that's good to hear, because I was worried about people after, you know, interviewing students, and I was like, wow, yeah, people just, it seems like people don't have time. Or I think especially when you're in university and you're young, I think that there's also an aspect of like transience that plays into it. I know like a lot of my friends, we were just talking about this last night, which is kind of, it's like, okay, well, after I graduate, you know, okay, I want to go travel, and I'm going to go where kind of a job takes me. So I can't settle down right now. And that kind of spurs maybe this like fear of commitment. Maybe not a fear, but like a kind of a...
Just waiting, like pushing it back. And I think there's totally nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
So I say like, just live your life. Fall in love when you fall in love. You'll be fine.
Very true. So you have a book that came out in 2017, is that correct? Yeah. And so it's also about romantic love. So do you want to kind of maybe quickly touch on what the book is about?
Sure. So it's called How to Fall in Love with Anyone. It is a collection of essays. And basically, each essay explores some aspect of, excuse me, of the gap between how we talk about love and how we actually practice it. So it's like a blend of research from a variety of different disciplines. So everything from like the neurochemistry of romantic love to sociological theories of storytelling. It's also memoir, personal reflection, cultural criticism. So it's all that stuff. Basically, I just wanted to really like think deeply about the role of love stories in our culture and think about like how we actually practice love and the ways in which maybe that's different from our stories. So one of the essays is kind of the longer story of that modern love column and sort of thinking about that experience that I was talking about of just like suddenly having like reading about seeing my own love story become the kind of love story that I'm like criticizing, which was interesting. But yeah.
Cool. So you obviously write about love a lot, and it's like you're kind of an expert on it. so why love? Like, why do you enjoy writing about it?
So first of all, I would say that I am often called an expert, and I really resist that label. I like to think about myself as someone who is curious and good at research, and like I've accumulated a lot of knowledge, but I really started from a position of just like really feeling like I wasn't doing love well. That maybe everything I thought I knew about love was wrong, and that there had to be a better way of understanding it. So for me, it was really like, here's this thing that's giving me a lot of anxiety, that's making me feel really disempowered. I think so many of our narratives of love position us really passively, like it's this thing that happens to us and we don't really have a lot of say over it, especially, that's especially true for heterosexual women. And so I wanted a different way to think about it. So I just thought, like, okay, maybe science can give me like an alternative narrative or an alternative point of view. And so I don't know, I spent like 7-8 years just like immersing myself in the research. So yeah, so I learned a lot, but I still am uncomfortable with that expert, with that label of expert, because I think it implies that I have something figured out and that I'm going to be good at it, when really, like, it's this huge, complicated topic that really we've only been investigating from a scientific perspective for the past, like, 20 to 40 years, depending on the discipline. And so there's so much that we don't know, and I would count myself among the people that, like, is interested. Because I've made so many bad decisions, which doesn't feel quite like expertise.
Yeah, so kind of going back to your 2015 article that, you know, was so popular, and kind of, yeah, talking about this kind of, like, resistance to the expert label, do you find that people kind of read your articles and then kind of want or almost interpret you as like their therapist, or they kind of want you to like give, like they kind of see you as like a godlike figure who can give them all the answers?
I sometimes feel like people want me to be my therapist. I think that's less about me and more about it's really more about this sense of disempowerment. So it's like, I think we have these cultural narratives that like love is supposed to be mysterious and unknowable, and it's this really powerful force, and like we can't understand it, shouldn't bother to try. And I think that leaves us all in this really horrible position. And it's crazy to think like, oh yeah, I'm not going to bother to really try to actively shape this part of my life. I'm just going to leave it to fate. When there's so many other parts of our lives that we would never do that with, right? Like, we would never do that with our careers, for example. And yet, love has just as big of an impact on our day-to-day lives as our careers do. You know, it shapes, like, where we live and who we hang out with and how we spend our time. And I think it's so important. So I don't know. For that reason, I think people will often turn to anyone who says like, oh, what if we did it differently? Like, what if we were more intentional about it? And so I went through a phase where I got a lot of emails from strangers. And if I had to summarize all the emails, they were from all over the world. And most of them were essentially could be summarized as, I'm in love with this person, they don't love me back, or they don't love me the way I want them to, how can I make them love me the way I want them to? You know, and the answer to that is like, you can't, which is not a very satisfying answer, but I think that's how it works, right? Like, we all, like, a really rewarding relationship is when we're two people or more are actively saying, I choose to be with you. I'm here. I'm showing up. This is what I want with my life. And I think to get yourself in that position really is really hard. And it takes a lot of, like, intentionality. And it requires, like, rejecting a lot of this sort of ideologies that we have about love. And that just takes, like, a lot of time and thinking and practice. And I've been writing about this for many years. And sometimes I feel like, yeah, I've got this. Like, my partner and I are creating a really intentional relationship. And other times I think, like, those notions of what love should look like are really seductive, and they still impact me, so.
Yeah, wow, really interesting. I hadn't really ever thought about love as being so intentional, and yeah, I've been thinking about it a lot more lately. Like, I recently broke up with a long-term boyfriend, and it's been really hard, but I think, yeah, like, hearing other people's experiences is really helpful. Like, I feel like there's a reason why love is, like, modern love column is so popular, is because people want to hear other people's experiences about it. Yeah. And
yeah, and I think what the column does is it's like this multiplicity of voices, mm-hmm. which is really nice, because I think our narratives are pretty narrow, right? Like in popular culture, this is changing, but most love stories really follow this, like, what I call the love marriage baby carriage trajectory, which is like, this is the best kind of love. It's like the ideal kind of love that everyone should aim for. If you have a relationship that is short, or that doesn't last for the duration of both of your lives, or that doesn't produce children or whatever. I mean, I think there were all these ways where we're like, oh, well, that doesn't count, which is ridiculous, because I think we can have all kind, like, love can be a meaningful part of our lives in so many different ways, and we don't always acknowledge that. And so the modern love column is a great example of, like, there are all these counter narratives in there that sort of exist to make the dominant narrative more complex, I guess.
Thank you so much, Mandy, for doing this interview and for joining us on the show.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thank you.
That ship out there will be smashed to bits. Use your emergency equipment.
It won't work. Nothing works. It's got to. It's no use. Everything seems to be stuck.
My life's worth a try anyway. Come on, fellas. You can make it.
Just listen to this. Spider-Man saves freighter. You can't tell me the captain couldn't have brought his ship in without the help of that publicity-seeking show-off, Spider-Man!
Don't get caught wasting power. Unplug cell phone, camera, and other battery chargers when charging is complete. Many electronic devices continue to use power even when you are not operating them. The amount of energy consumed by electronics in a year when they were not in use could power Whistler Blackcomb Resorts for 43 years. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
Hey, did you know?
More than 4,500 Canadians are waiting for an organ transplant right now.
Right now. 4,500.
People are dying.
And you could save a life. 90% of Canadians say they're willing to donate their organs.
But only a few are registered.
So what are you waiting for?
Get registered.
It's easy and it's free.
Leave a legacy.
Be a hero.
Save a life.
Find out how to register today. Go to kidney.ca.
Okay, so we're back on UBC Happy Hour, and you just heard my interview with Mandy Carton. I always want to say Carton, but yeah, who is an English prof here at UBC and a creative writing prof. And yeah, she's written about love, and yeah, she had some really awesome things to say about love in the modern era, but also the 36 question dating experiment. So would you guys do it? The 36 question?
Yes.
Absolutely.
That'd be interesting.
100%. But my only caveat is I wouldn't know how to bring up that in conversation. You know, it's like you meet someone, it's like, now let's do this thing and maybe fall in love.
I feel like you already need to be somewhat close to that person. You can't just be like, hi, we met at the cafe and I'm asking you on a date. And also, will you try to fall in love with me?
Yeah.
It also, in some ways, knowing that these questions could make you fall in love, could put a lot of pressure on your answers, on the questions. Mm-hmm. I feel it would need to be run. If I were to do it, I wouldn't tell the person. I would just ask them these questions and just...
deceive them.
I mean, it's kind of like trapping them.
No, you're right, though. It's like you could try to, like, make your question, like, you might not answer them honestly. You just be like, want to sound good. Like, if you're on a first date and you're very superficial, like me.
Like everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah, they're also just really, they get really personal, you know? It's also like, whoa.
Can I just read the 35th question? Because I was just, like, browsing through it, and it's, wow. Number 35. Of all the people in your family, whose death would you find most disturbing? Why? That'll make you fall in love. What?
That's so intense. Wow. Okay.
I think that is really intense.
Yeah, I think that this would be really fun. Yeah, not just to do like with a potential romantic partner, but just like with a friend. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or I was texting my brother about this, and he was like, "Oh, he's like, that's crazy. I did that on like a road trip with my friends this summer, you know, to kill time." And I think that that's like a really
that's so sweet. Good. I think there are so many types of love, and like for me, like my real friend, like I genuinely love them. Like it's not like I don't know how, like you know.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, love exists in many forms. And
definitely.
Yeah, and that's kind of part, like, that's definitely, I think, part of what, like, Mandy is writing about is how, yeah, like, this love doesn't have to be kind of, like, this one, like, narrative, right? And, like, how she talked about how that is so prevalent, in, like, in the modern love column and why it's probably so popular is because... yeah, like hearing all these different stories is really, I think, refreshing for a lot of people.
Yeah, and sometimes we're fed such a myth of love and what love should be like, whether it's like through media, or through our parents, or in so many different ways. It's such an idyllic thing about like, ooh, love, you know? It's like, it's what like you're looking for. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, so kind of to close off the show, so Julia Ferry, who's one of our contributors, so she did an interview with a philosophy professor here at UBC named Carrie Jenkins, who is also really awesome. Yeah, we get to interview so many amazing people and so many amazing women on the show. So Carrie Jenkins is a philosophy professor here, and she has a kind of a think project called The Metaphysics of Love. So this is going to take you on like a whirlwind through a new kind of way of thinking about love. Carrie is going to definitely talk about kind of what we were just discussing, which is like this kind of like one, you know, narrative around love and how we can kind of shift that. This is Julia and Carrie's interview.
We are here with Carrie Jenkins. Could you give yourself a little introduction, please?
For sure. I'm Carrie. I'm a professor in the UBC Department of Philosophy. At the moment, I'm also teaching in the Arts One program, so I put in a little plug for the Arts One program, which is amazing. I work on the philosophy of love, among other things. I'm really interested in the metaphysics of romantic love.
So it's a perfect time right now in February.
It's a good time to do this kind of work. So many people want to talk about this. And I'm like, yes, I am ready.
So do a lot of people come and call you and say, hey, I would like to talk about love? Or
I mean, it happens, you know, throughout the year. People are interested in this subject. Just it is something that people think about. But then something happens culturally, socially around Valentine's Day when we're being prompted all the time to think about love, and I think it's in some ways that's a good thing because it's not just an opportunity to consume greeting cards and candy related products, it's also a good opportunity to think about what it is that we're consuming and also constructing when we buy into all of this romantic ideology.
So what kind of questions do you get?
People ask all kinds of things, and if there's one thing that I have learned from talking about this stuff, my work is a lot more public-facing now than it used to be since I started working on love, and so I get all kinds of questions. But, I mean, honestly, the classics are very popular. What is love is very popular, and I never get bored of that one. but then, you know, beyond that, it comes down to a lot of people are very interested in... trying to figure out how much of what we think of as, quotes, normal, and I'm doing scare quotes here for normal, how much of what we think of as normal is coming to us from a socially constructed narrative that we have just absorbed through this kind of osmosis, just by living in the social context that we live in, and how much of it is natural or biological or what we're in some sense designed to do. I think most of the interesting philosophical questions arise at the intersection of those things, where we're trying to untangle what belongs on which side, and even just to appreciate that both elements are in play can be really empowering sometimes. You know, it's not all biology and unchangeable and there's nothing we can do. There are interventions that we can make. Even the parts that are biological, I'm not sure that they're completely unchangeable either, but that's a separate question.
Interesting. Well, that's quite intriguing. So I guess that we spoke a little bit about the corporate side of Valentine's Day and how we're buying greeting cards and there's kind of prompts and social cues to think about love. Could we dive into first the biological aspect of what you think is love and then move on to the social social side?
Yeah. The biology it's really hard to answer with any kind of specificity, partly because we're dealing with things like the human brain, and, you know, even the best experts in the world don't know exactly how that thing works, and I'm certainly not the best expert in the world on how the human brain works. What we do know is that a certain amount of fMRI studies, for example, have shown patterns of activation in brain regions when you show people who are newly and passionately in love pictures of their beloved. You can see the involvement of certain kinds of neurochemistry, certain areas of the brain suggestive of similarities, for example, between that state and chemical addiction and obsessions and compulsions and things like this, which, you know, I think for people who've been in that situation might not be a terribly surprising thing to learn, but it can help us understand why some of the behaviors look similar, right? The brain chemistry looks similar. And so, you know, I think I'm very hesitant to downplay or ignore the role of biology in this picture, because we are ultimately naturally occurring animal phenomenon, right? We do have an evolutionary history and it's part of the story. So obviously that particular piece of brain chemistry is not the only biological response, but it's one of the important ones. It's one of the really fascinating ones. But I think that one of the things we're tempted to do, and I feel this temptation myself sometimes, and I think a lot of other people do as well, is to project more onto biology than really belongs there. And you see this play out in the history of all kinds of socially important but also contentious phenomena. So you look at the history of gender, for example, and the history of women being told that they're biologically incapable of whatever, mathematics or leadership or whatever it might be. And the history of trying to biologize racism, or trying to make biological excuses for racism, right, or to attribute this thing that we are actually doing to each other, to some sort of power outside of our control. And so I think the same thing can be seen in some of the ideologies surrounding romantic love. So we in Vancouver are living in a kind of social context where there's one normative family and relationship structure, and it's a monogamous, lifelong partnership that may involve marriage, it may involve kids, and it may involve a little house with a picket fence. And that's what we're taught to think of as, quotes, the normal way to do romantic love, right? And then there's the whole sort of rom-com, meet cute, you know, bolt from the blue. It's quite a lot of scripting, really, for how the story is supposed to go. But anyway, we have this kind of normative picture, and it's very easy, I think, to slide between thinking of that as extremely familiar, which it is, and then assuming that it must be natural in the sense of coming to us out of biology, something that's dictated by our biology, In fact, I have a lot of questions about how much of that is, quotes, natural in the sense of coming to us out of biology. And in particular, when you look at how relationship structures, family structures differ across times and places, the idea that only one model is natural or dictated by biology starts to look really implausible. Mm-hmm. Because if it was, you'd really expect it to be more statistically normal and not just normal in the sense of what you're, quote, supposed to do. And so I think there's more of a conversation happening now than there used to be that questions things like the naturalness of, let's say, monogamy, and certainly the naturalness of the idea of all relationships having to be hetero, mm-hmm. and the naturalness of even like the idea that a relationship has to be permanent, otherwise it's a failure, right? If it ends, that's some sort of failure, and it means it wasn't, quotes, true love, or it wasn't real love, or something like that. We are having those conversations, but ultimately, what I think all of that is pointing to is the fact that we have constructed this, I call it a script, you know, this idea mm-hmm. of one standard model that love, romantic love, is supposed to look like, and that, I think, does not come out of biology at all. Like, biology is very variable, right? No, there isn't just one way that humans do anything, right? So mm-hmm. for some people, monogamy and permanence and picket fence or whatever might feel really comfortable, very natural. For other people, none of that might feel right at all. And I sometimes compare this to eye color, which is like, yes, it's a biological phenomenon. Lots of people have blue eyes, and that's a very natural thing. But other people have brown eyes, and that's also a very natural thing. And there isn't one natural eye color for humans, and I think similarly there isn't one natural kind of relationship for mm-hmm. humans.
But thinking about these questions then, because they must take a lot of time to think about and a lot of energy, where do you think this energy is going to? What do you hope to see by answering these questions to be able to identify these situations of love?
It's a great question. And like, really, I see my role less as answering questions than getting those questions onto more people's agenda. You know, I try to answer some questions as far as I can, but I'm much less interested when I discuss with someone, or, you know, I write a book and somebody reads it, I'm much less interested in whether they agree with me than I am about whether they're now thinking about that question for themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that in a lot of ways, my main goal, and certainly with the book that I wrote, my main goal is to get that conversation more squarely on the table. And by that conversation, I mean any conversation that asks what love is, what it means to individual people. Because the one of the worries that I have is I see a lot of people ending up very unhappy, potentially even at risk, because of misunderstandings about what love is. This is a part of my work that's very influenced by people like Bell Hooks. She also has motivations of the same kind, where people are, for example, confused about the difference between loving relationships and abusive relationships. Perhaps they haven't had models of love that make it clear that those things are different. And, you know, not being able to talk about what love is and what you want out of love, right? And this is not the same as what necessarily I or anyone else wants, but what you want for yourself. Not being able to have that conversation is a big part of that problem. There shouldn't be a default. These should all be, these conversations about what love means to each person should be happening. And so part of my goal is just to get more of those conversations happening. And so whatever is the outcome of those conversations, I feel like every time one of them happens, that's a success, that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. Even if the upshot is that the person thinks I'm completely wrong, I'm really looking for ways to empower people with, I think of it as like conceptual tools, mm-hmm. to ask these kinds of questions. And so that's why I start talking about the social constructed elements, or why I start kind of analyzing things like the ways we use metaphor around love. So we talk about falling, right, which mm-hmm. is a passive thing that happens to you outside of your control. What if we talked about choosing? And we talk about love as if it was a kind of mental illness, right, or a kind of warfare. And again, I'm drawing on a lot of work that's been done in that case in English literature departments to kind of get at the ways that we currently think about love that are not maybe right on the surface and just bring them up to the surface. It's like there's a metaphor for this that I love, which is Mary Midgley. She's a British philosopher, and she says sometimes our conceptual plumbing is not good, but because it's all under the floorboards, you can't see it. All you notice is these really bad smells coming up from under the floorboards. And so, and then she says what she thinks of philosophy as doing is like getting in with your plunger or whatever under the floorboards and trying to find the source of the stink. And it's sometimes the work's really gross, right? It kind of philosophy is not always a very glamorous thing, and she makes that point really nicely with this metaphor, I think. Mm-hmm. It's not very nice, you know?
Yeah. I know. Yeah.
So but yeah, that's kind of how I'm thinking. I like her imagery, and I like this idea that it's about tackling the concepts that underlie the thinking. Mm-hmm. Which then manifest in things like the metaphors that we use, or what kind of cards are on sale at the diamond advertisements, and all of this pressure, which I think a lot of the time some of the reasons why people start asking these questions is the pressure is very real, right? Even if what we've constructed is in some sense a sort of a fairy tale, by the time people are pressuring you to do it, that's real. Like, that's not a fairy tale anymore. That's no longer something we've made up in the sense of it being like a Harry Potter made up. It's like we've made it up like we've made up the law. Now suddenly you're expected to conform to that. And so that, I think, is another way that a lot of people find themselves in this philosophical state of mind where they're like, hang on a second. Mm-hmm. Is it me or this thing I'm supposed to do? Or is it just a mismatch?
Yeah.
Between the two.
Which is a useful tool, considering that if that default itself is questioned, then I guess you can start trying to satisfy your needs. And
exactly. And I mean, like I sometimes talk about this in terms of love crafting. Mm-hmm. Like the idea of being creative and thinking about love as an enterprise that involves collaboration, right? Mm-hmm. The creation of something, having these conversations, challenging the defaults. Ultimately, all good philosophy is about challenging defaults of some kind or other, or getting at those assumptions that everyone's making but nobody's quite talking about. And so, yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, that's the main goal, right?
Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of agency you're giving to a lot of people, I feel that. I mean, instead of having to say, oh, according to this poet, I love you, you can just say, oh, I love you. Like, I think that's a quote from Slavoj Žižek, but...
According to this poet.
Yeah. I mean, people can own those emotions and feelings, which is, I think, a very important aspect.
Yeah, I think it is. And agency is another word I like to use for this. Thinking again about love as something crafted, love as a practice, helps with moving away from that sort of everything's just out of control and I don't need to, there's no point trying to challenge anything or change anything. And so, yeah, agency, I think, is the key to unlocking that shift in ways of thinking. I mean, everybody else's mileage may vary, but I find that to be a very empowering thought, and also one that challenges a huge range of default assumptions. Things like rape culture, where the idea that, say, men cheating is just acceptable because it's inevitable, like, very easily bleeds into this thought that men can't really control themselves sexually, and these things are very tightly connected together with the thought that love is somehow out of control, so you're not responsible for what you do, right? If you're really into somebody, you can't be blamed for anything that you do to them. It's like, no, that's actually, that's not, that sounds very romantic when you say, like, oh, it's just, I'm out of control. I mean, look, this does not sound so romantic when you realize that that ideology manifests as stalking behavior or other kinds of abusive behaviors, and then saying that it's the person doing that's not responsible for those behaviors. It's like, mm-hmm. Suddenly doesn't sound so cute anymore. Mm-hmm. So I think part of the, and again, this is bell hooks in action here, part of that shift in towards thinking about agency and what we choose to do is about speaking back to that potentially quite dangerous conception of love as out of control and excusing whatever kind of behaviors you mm-hmm. engage in. Mm-hmm. By thinking about what media we consume or what media we produce and what stories we tell, right? That's ultimately what that boils down to, right? What kinds of stories do we tell? Do we want to keep telling the same story over and over again, which is some version of Cinderella? or do we maybe want to hear more stories and tell more stories? And, you know, my answer is the second thing, please. And I sort of feel like once people see that that's an option, I don't think I'm the only person who's going to want that, right? They want to hear more stories, more different kinds of love stories, given proper representation. And...
Well, I guess on that note, thank you so much, Carrie Jenkins. So you have the book, What Love Is,
yes.
Was that correct?
Yes, the book's full title is What Love Is and What It Could Be. Mm-hmm. That second part is important. the second part is the hopeful part, and the first part is sometimes a little bit not so inspiring. But yeah, so What Love Is and What It Could Be, it's published by Basic Books and should be on bookstores and Amazon and places mm-hmm. like that.
So to the audience, there's lots of possibilities for love.
There really are, and they might not look like what you think they would look like.
Three women, dressed in lingerie, were hanging from the ceiling on meat hooks. In an adjacent room, a man was in bed with two deceased females, also wearing lingerie. He positioned their arms in a sexy embrace. Down the hall, a man holding a chainsaw stood over the motionless body of a sixth woman, lying on a table covered in plastic. These are scenes from a popular music video by a Grammy Award-winning artist. If we want violence against women to stop, shouldn't we stop treating it like entertainment? Join the conversation at #NotOkay.
La Fondation canadienne pour le dialogue des cultures présente son nouveau projet Baldwin et La Fontaine vers le gouvernement responsable. Apprenez en famille, entre amis et à l'école sur l'engagement de ces deux personnages importants dans l'avènement du gouvernement canadien tel qu'on le connaît aujourd'hui. Visitez le site baldwinlafontaine.ca pour y découvrir des capsules vidéo, des documentaires et un guide pédagogique. Participez au concours national en ligne pour courir la chance de gagner un voyage à Toronto pour deux personnes ou une bourse d'études post-secondaire.
Tu envoies ce soir?
Yes, I do.
Woo! Make some noise!